criminal procedure class at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Would they stand, please? Well, welcome. Thank you for coming. What class is this? I know, but who is the instructor? Okay, counsel, thank you for coming and bringing them. But I see you're not arguing it. All right. Thank you. You may be seated. Welcome to you all. Susan, is it Alicia?
Alicia.
Assistant State Public Defender of Madison, representing Mr. Kelsey. Would you proceed?
Good afternoon. As the Chief Justice said, my name is Susan Alicia, and I'm representing Kelsey this afternoon. This is kind of a classic Fourth Amendment case in that we have a stop and we have a search, and we're here to tell you that both of those were illegal, and therefore the evidence should be suppressed. But I think what separates this case from a whole bunch of other Fourth Amendment cases that you see is the search. And I suspect that's why we're here today and why this court was interested in this case, because the search presents the question of whether an officer can search somebody because he's putting that person in the squad car. And because I think that's such a significant question, I'm going to focus on that today in my argument. And I'll be happy to take questions about the stop and talk about that if you want me to. But what I want to focus on is the search, because I think that's what's critical here.
Well, we usually talk about a stop and frisk. Is this a frisk, or is it a search, or is there a difference?
I say it's a frisk, mm-hmm. because it's part of Terry. Mm-hmm. It's a Terry frisk pursuant to the Terry stop. Yes.
So you're looking for weapons.
Yes.
Does it make any difference about where the person was going to go? Does that make any difference that it was going to... she was going to go to the back of the car and sit in with the officer?
No.
The car makes no difference.
No. Because we're talking about Terry, and the Terry standard is if there's a reasonable suspicion, the person is armed and dangerous. That's the standard, and that's what the issue is in this case. And that doesn't have an effect on where the person is in terms of whether they're sitting in the squad car for transportation or they're not.
Isn't the issue in this case, I mean, I don't want to blend your issues, you're going to present this, but it also is we're dealing with a 15-year-old girl, a young lady who the officer observes. In any event, I won't get into all of the facts, but it was where the mother, if I'm not mistaken, said, please bring her home, give her a ride home. And then we have a policy of the police not to have someone go into the vehicle without them knowing what would be on that person, basically knives, weapons of some type.
That's correct.
And that doesn't change it at all as far as what you're going to concentrate on number two, and you think number one has very little to do with it?
In terms of number one being
right.
the stop?
Right.
Well, I think the stop is related, but I really want to separate them out because I think that the critical question here is what happens when Kelsey is searched and why she is searched. And certainly what happened beforehand leads into that. But what I'm concerned about in this case is that there be a suggestion that there be a rule that says it's always okay.
Well, what about a rule that says, was there any state that says it's always okay, period?
No state has said it's always okay.
There have been some states that say that the practice of saying to somebody, I'm going to transport you in the car, that, but if you are to be so transported, I have to search you for my safety or safety of other people in the car. What about that rule?
The farthest any state has gone is Ohio and the Evans.
What does Ohio say?
It's State versus Evans. And what they say, I think, doesn't necessarily have a simple answer because it's a little bit of a complicated case. But this is what I see Evans saying in Ohio. That's a case where you have a routine traffic stop, but when the officer is talking to the person, they get information from a dispatch saying there's been a drug deal, and lo and behold, the driver they're talking to matches the description, as does the car. So what Ohio does, and again, I'll have to say what I think it says, it does these sort of parallel analysis first on whether just putting the person in the squad car creates a reason for them to frisk. And Ohio says, well, in this situation, yes, it does. They don't say anything blanket rule all the time, but they say in this situation, yes. But then it's interesting that they spend a lot of time in the opinion also talking about whether the information from dispatch justified the search. And they specifically say, the information we got from dispatch about the drug deal on its own supports the search.
Alicia, it seems to me that you have a hurdle to overcome before we even reach your issue. And that is whether or not there was reasonable suspicion to frisk her, given the facts, you know, nighttime, the neighborhood was tough, she had fled from the officers. I mean, we don't even reach your issue if we find that there was reasonable suspicion, do we?
If you find that there was reasonable suspicion under Terry, then yes. I mean, then you're saying that the search is okay. I mean, I still have the stop, and I don't want to give up the stop just
right.
by saying I'm talking about it.
I mean, for you to leap to the issue of what should the standard be when officers put a person, a citizen, into the back of the car seems to me to assume an awful lot that, at least in my mind, you shouldn't assume at all.
Well,
I think you have a huge hurdle. I mean, I start off leaning very, very hard towards reasonable suspicion.
I agree, and perhaps what I said wasn't clear, because from what I hear you saying, we're not at the same place.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, this...
You're using the term frisk to mean search, right?
Correct. What I'm saying is that we look at this case under Terry, and the search doesn't fly.
Okay,
that's what I'm saying. And I'm saying the only...
There aren't enough factors here justifying reasonable suspicion. It's just a hunch. That's your position?
Yes, correct. I'm saying there aren't factors here to say that there's a reasonable suspicion that she was armed and dangerous.
Nighttime, bad neighborhood. We've had that before.
Sure, you have.
15-year-old fleeing, the U.S. Supreme Court said is indicative, I think, is criminal activity.
But we have a different standard because we're not talking about criminal activity. We're talking about reasonable suspicion that she's armed and dangerous. And you could have that suspicion that there's criminal activity afoot and not have the belief, a reasonable suspicion, that she's armed and dangerous. Because criminal activity can mean a whole bunch of things. And flight can mean a whole lot of things, too. And talking about these factors as they apply to this case, nighttime, 8 o'clock. It happens to be 2 years ago today, interestingly enough. So it's dark. But when I read the nighttime cases, it seems to be 2 a.m., 4 a.m., midnight, not 8 o'clock. And if we're talking about darkness, well, it was a brightly lit area. I mean, the police officer specifically testified that this area is more brightly lit than a residential area would be. When we talk about flight, she ran. Why does somebody run? There are a lot of reasons why somebody might run. And remember the standard, reasonable suspicion, that she's armed and dangerous. Does running mean we jump to the armed and dangerousness? Running could mean I'm afraid, which is what she said. Running could mean panic.
So she's afraid of the police.
Right. A person could be afraid of the police either personally or from things they've heard. Panic. It could just be a bad choice at the moment. You're scared.
Could mean you've got something on you that you don't want the police to find.
Exactly, and that could be a whole lot of things. It could be drugs. They were looking for graffiti in this neighborhood. Maybe a person has some spray paint and they see the police and they run. There's just this continuum of reasons to run, and at the very end of that continuum is the weapon. And so to say that the flight equals we go as far as we can and say that's armed and dangerous is too great a leap. And the other thing that's really important in this case is you have the flight, but the flight doesn't stand alone. Okay, she runs for 45 seconds, and they get Kelsey. And then they talk to Kelsey. And then they call Kelsey's mom. And then they talk to Kelsey's mom. And then they say, well, we're going to put you in the car, so we're going to have a female officer search you. And Kelsey sits on the hood of the car for 20 minutes. Two officers, one officer goes into the squad car and leaves the other officer sitting out there with Kelsey for the 20 minutes that she sits on the hood. No indication of nervousness. Clearly, subjectively, the officers had no fear, and this is an objective test, but it's patently clear, and they say that this isn't an issue of their fearing for their safety. So you start looking at the flight and what happens after the flight, and I think the flight issue really diminishes. Even though standing on its own, I don't think that equates armed and dangerousness. When you look at what happens,
when we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, what part do you think the mother's request plays? The mother saying, "Bring her home. I really want you to bring her home." How does that enter into the totality?
Well, first of all, factually, the officer did testify that he was going to do it regardless of what the mother said. So in this case, you have the officer making the decision, and it doesn't matter. Mom did not prompt the officer to do it in this case. On a more general level, I think that's an area that it becomes dangerous to say that because mom said we should do it. Because what if mom said, "Boy, I can't believe that Kelsey ran from police. She needs to learn a lesson. I want you to take her down to the station and scare her straight." You know, is the officer then in a position of saying, "Well, gosh, I wasn't going to, but mom suggested that I take her downtown, so well, now I'm going to do it."
Did the officer testify that he was acting on a policy, or did he testify that this was just his normal practice?
I believe he used the word policy, and I'd have to look back and see whether he said my policy or our policy, in terms if you're asking whether it was a police department.
I am indeed.
I believe he said my, but I have the quote here in my brief. And the other interesting thing about him saying that is he also talked about how it's his policy. Well, he says we. As a matter of policy, I'm looking at page 19 of my brief. As a matter of policy, we have the option. I think, let's see. We might have one more. I think it's also interesting to note that he talks about his policy being asking for consent before he searches, something that he didn't do in this case.
So do you think the bottom line is that it's his personal policy rather than a Milwaukee police policy?
I guess the bottom line from this record is I'm saying I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Would it make a difference if it was his policy as against a policy enunciated by the police department?
No, because I think if there's a policy that's created that violates the Fourth Amendment, wherever it comes from, it still violates the Fourth Amendment.
And you're convinced that if such a policy existed, it would be a violation?
Yes.
Do you agree with what Justice Babich was asking about earlier, that you've got to get across the hurdle of reasonable suspicion and an objective test before we ever get to the policy issue?
Yeah, yes. I think that my position is we should never get to the policy issue, because that kind of a blanket policy is just directly contrary to the Fourth Amendment. We don't get there. So then what we're left with, the only reason this search could be good is Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not good under Terry either. So then there's nothing.
Could I ask you a question? If I want to enter the Outagamie County Courthouse in Appleton, say to visit the sheriff, I must go through a metal detector. If I take my wallet out and I'm carrying a gun, all sorts of things will go off. What reasonable suspicion that I'm armed and dangerous do they have, or how do you distinguish that situation?
Well, I guess my first thought is it's different from a pat-down. I mean, you're talking about a different, in terms of walking through. I mean, it happens at airports too, right? You walk through. The other thing would be perhaps there's some consent involved there because you're choosing to go through there. I mean, you see this, and you still choose to go through there. An officer isn't saying, up against the wall, Justice Prosser, I'm going to pat you down now, and you're saying, wait, that's not what I want, or I don't accept that. So,
did she ever object to riding in the vehicle?
She didn't. She was never asked. It just sort of got rolling along. There was never a consent issue in this case because the officer specifically testified I didn't ask her for consent.
Why wasn't she under arrest?
She wasn't under arrest because when you look at Swanson and you look at the criteria under Swanson, they talk about what the officer actually did as opposed to what he's thinking about. So in this situation, you have Kelsey sitting on the roof of the car, and it's pretty clear that they're taking her home, or it seems to me that they're taking her home, not necessarily as a punishment, but as a, well, Kelsey, we're going to take you home now. We're going to get you out of the situation. And for her to be in the position of, I'm under arrest, I'm not free to leave, they've forced me into this position, they've handcuffed me, they've told me I'm under arrest. None of that ever happened.
They ran after her. They stopped her. Clearly, she's not free to walk away. She's tried that. They won't let her walk away. Why isn't she under arrest? Now, my next question to you be, if you don't want to say she's under arrest, because then a full custodial search can follow. But you're in the same place. Under what basis do they arrest her? So if the arrest is bad, the search is bad.
Right.
So you have. So what's the matter with an arrest here? She's not free to go. They don't think she's free to go. She doesn't think she's free to go. And so what are they going to arrest her for? Truancy? No. Being out at 7:45? No. Being in a bad neighborhood? No. Being against her mother's will? Mother told her to stay home, or mother doesn't want her there? No. So what are they going to arrest her for?
Well, the only thing we have out there is the obstructing.
Pardon? It's what?
The obstructing.
Oh, because she fled.
Correct. And they said they were going to issue her a citation for that.
Yeah. And what's the, and that's a criminal offense.
Well, they were going to issue an ordinance citation for it. So
it's not a criminal.
It's not a criminal.
Is there a criminal offense of obstruction?
There is a criminal offense of obstruction.
They're going to do a citation. So then the issue is, can you arrest on a citation?
Well, I don't think that's the issue. I mean, here, I don't know who the oral argument is. Here, isn't the fact that it doesn't matter whether they're going to issue her a citation or not, we can look at it afresh, as we said in McGill, and determine that under all the circumstances, this was an arrest, even if the officer couldn't articulate it.
That's right. The officer's unarticulated plan isn't relevant.
Right.
But what was the officer's articulated plan? He called mom. You know, I mean, when you look at the trappings of an arrest and you look at Swanson and what you think of as an arrest, I mean, I agree that free to leave, she certainly probably didn't feel that way. On the other hand, they're taking her home to mom. I mean, the issue, the whole atmosphere surrounding this doesn't seem to me to be this custodial, boy, you're in trouble now, Kelsey. It's, look, Kelsey, we're going to take you home to mom.
Well, the chief, I think, has really put her finger on a tough problem for you. Because, as you well know, if the arrest is okay, then the frisk is okay. The search is okay. Usually the public defender's in this court saying that their client in no way felt free to leave, and therefore there was an arrest. Now, can you with a straight face argue before this court that she felt free to leave?
It's a difficult thing for me to say. I mean, I have to be honest with you, it's a difficult thing to say. But, you know, frankly, when I read a lot of these arrest cases, I say to myself, that person wasn't free to leave. Mm-hmm. And so it's a different thing for me to stand up here and say, gosh, I don't know if she'd feel free to leave, and for me to look at the law and look at the cases and see what the test is and see these situations like they mentioned in Swanson where there was no arrest found, where the police drew their weapons or where they handcuffed the person or where they use force. I mean, you put me in handcuffs, I don't feel free to leave. But Swanson says, sure, you could still feel free to leave. That's not an arrest if there's handcuffs.
I looked at this case, and I didn't read the record, so I looked at this case in part based on the way that the Court of Appeals looked at the facts of this case. The text of the Court of Appeals opinion is that what was going on here is the community caretaker function. Here was a young girl in the community at night. Persons under the age of 18 may be taken into custody by law enforcement if they're runaways. An officer who believes that a person under the age of 18 may be a runaway has the right to investigate. That's the way I guess I've seen the case, and that's the way certainly the Court of Appeals treated it. What I have a problem with is if they thought it was she was a runaway, and lo and behold, then she splits. It seems to me, that flight may indicate reasonable suspicion of some kind of criminal activity or some kind of unlawful activity. And they stop it, and they get it. And so that reasonable suspicion is for unlawful activity. Then you have another, although you use the same words, reasonable suspicion. They have to have reasonable suspicion, a la Terry, in order to frisk her, in order to search her. Now, they called the mother, so if they're concerned, like the Court of Appeals says, that she's a runaway, they call the mother, and that seems to me to dispel any thought that she's a runaway. The mother doesn't think she's a runaway. So what is, so that kind of takes away the, for me, part of the unlawful activity. So what is the reasonable, and she's not, let's say she's not arrested, that's the way it was treated in the Court of Appeals. And of course if she were arrestee, she could be frisked, you know, but searched. But what is the reasonable suspicion then for the frisk?
There isn't reasonable suspicion for the frisk.
Well, let me ask a different question. You are Officer Gonzalez.
I know that's your position.
You are Officer Gonzalez. You have people in your squad car all the time. When are you entitled to pat them down before you put them and transport them?
That's a very good question and a very important question, because you have lots of opportunities legally to do that. You have a person under arrest, search incident to an arrest. I would imagine a lot of people, when you look at the group of people that are ending up in squad cars, a lot of those people are under arrest. Then you have consent, voluntary consent. Then it's an okay search too. Then you have, if you have a reasonable suspicion or an objectively reasonable suspicion that the person is armed and dangerous, then you can search too. So an officer has a lot of situations. In fact, I would say the vast majority of the situations that they ever deal with, they have that protection already there through exceptions to the warrant requirement. So what we're left with are these little slices that I don't know how often they even come up. And that's what concerns me about trying to broaden this out too far in a fact situation that probably isn't all that common.
Well, let's take the example of a state trooper in Wisconsin, and it's one of the I systems, and a person runs out of gas. You're not allowed to step out of the car. He pulled the car off on the road, so the person calls and says to the trooper that I'm out of gas. What do you think the trooper does? Troopers come and say that they'll transport you to the nearest gas station. And you have to fill a tank and bring it back, and they'll do that. And then it's up to you to return this tank, 5-gallon tank, to the gas station. So they come and they're going to put you in the squad car. There's no crime here. No speeding, no drunk driving, no broken windshield, no tailpipe missing, no muffler. Perfect car, right? And they're doing a community caretaker function, right? But, you know, who knows what I have on me? Winter, wearing a heavy coat, I could have anything. Maybe I don't look suspicious, but I'm a dangerous person. And so Can they say, we're frisking you first?
They can say, if you want to ride, we're going to frisk you first.
And then I'm giving consent.
If you agree to it,
it's
yes.
It's not too voluntary, but I don't have too many choices, but that's not the issue about consent, right?
That's right.
Okay, but suppose they don't say that to me, which they didn't say to this young girl. They just say, okay, get in the back, and I'm frisking you first. And they say to me, get in the back, frisking you first.
Then that's,
and then find my large knife, which I carry for self-protection, or a can of mace, or whatever is illegal.
Then I say that is an illegal search, and whatever
that's
they find has to be suppressed.
And even though it's a community caretaker service, it's very important that we not let people walk around on the I-90 system for community safety. And there are no ill will towards me, no suspicion. This isn't a pretextual search. You're going to say that the police officer can't search them before I get in the car and are potentially really dangerous, even though there's a barrier between the front and back, etc.
Yes.
That's
because
the position of public defenders.
Because the officer isn't so limited either. I mean, if you take your hypothetical worries, the person needs to get gas. Well, if the officer is that concerned about his safety and the person won't consent, all right, we'll go get it. Or is there somebody we can call that can come pick you up?
Well, they can tell me to call AAA.
I mean, the officer is in a situation where if he or she is not comfortable with that person refusing the consent, then the officer isn't in a box.
Well, very frankly, if I don't consent, and that officer's standing there, and we're eyeball to eyeball, I'd have a little suspicion about me and what I'm carrying. Is that good enough for to frisk me? I mean, wouldn't you be suspicious of me if you were the officer?
If a person refused the ride, I think it's important that if that be the rule, that they're required to ask for consent, that you can't then bootstrap the refusal of consent into meaning, well, now I have reasonable suspicion, because then the person has to say yes.
Yeah, well, does it make any difference on the age? Here we have, obviously, if it was 17 years old or
15.
Here we have a younger person who they've already contacted the mother, and then that person says, no, I don't want, and that's, you'd have more suspicion than you would if you had had no contact or the person was older. But as I say, as you go down the scale, so you're saying no matter what, there is no circumstance in which a person could be patted down.
Against their will and without their consent, yes. Because I think if you say the same no to the question, then why ask the question?
So age, yeah, and age makes no difference. So if this was a 10-year-old, I'm just to use an example, and it was the same time, the same thing, the same chase, and the mother said, please bring the person home, then the policeman is faced with this. If the person doesn't want to, and the 10-year-old says, well, don't touch me. I mean, come on. But let's say, assuming that's true, then he has to arrange a ride, find out, or what, just leave the person standing there? Then what's the liability? What would be the liability if something happened?
Well, I don't think the officer does have to leave the person standing here. I mean, we come back to Kelsey's situation. You have Mom on the phone. You could say, Mom, you come pick up Kelsey, or say to the 10-year-old, who do you know that can, or what can we do? Can we walk you home? Where are you? I mean, it's going to be so fact-specific, and that's what the Fourth Amendment is. I mean, the fact situations are going to be ripe with all these little pieces of information.
But we don't have Mom coming to pick her up here. Mom,
we don't have volunteer. Mom. No, we don't. Nobody asked Mom, yeah. According to the record.
Mom didn't volunteer.
Suppose the officer said to Mom, oh, look, if I take her home, I've got to search her because that's my policy, the police policy, whatever policy. And the mother says, go ahead, be my guest.
My position is the mother can't consent to a personal search of her 15-year-old daughter.
For anybody.
What's the age where a child can be moved into adult court?
Well, the child can be moved into adult court pretty young for, if you have something like a first-degree intentional homicide.
Yeah,
so 10, right.
Yes.
But I think that maybe another way to point at a statute and to say, you know, not in this case, is at 15, the statutes say the child can be released on her own. The officers for a 15-year-old can just 15 and up, they can just say, go on your way.
But the point is that that differs. If you had a 9-year-old, then you'd probably, I don't know, you'd say yes, then the mother could control that. But if the law says you can be charged as an adult when you're 10, then that makes a difference.
I just think it's really difficult to try to fit hypotheticals into a situation where I guess you're creating a blanket rule and saying you can always. Then you can always do that for a 10-year-old? What about an 11-year-old or a 9-year-old? I mean, the line drawing becomes really difficult, and we don't have to do that line drawing if we stick with the analysis we already have, which are these fact-specific, what are the circumstances?
The Terry analysis.
And not to mention, of course, we have a 15-year-old here, and that isn't the situation. So in Kelsey's case, I mean, I think the whole argument still holds true.
But you can also solve the line drawing problem by establishing a bright line rule that any time anybody is transported in a squad car, the search is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. What's wrong with that?
Oh, I have a lot that's wrong with that. My red light's
going. No, you've already summarized what's wrong with that. It's not consensual, and there's no probable cause to support an arrest. But why does it have to be independent reasonable basis like consent or search incident to an arrest? Why is that not good enough to make it reasonable under the Fourth Amendment?
Because I think if you start getting into a position where you say something is always okay under the Fourth Amendment, a blanket rule, look, we're just going to say as a blanket rule it's okay to search everybody that goes in the squad car. It's very clear. There isn't any debate about it then. But the blanket rule, I mean, as I said, I have so much to say about it. It's such a bad idea. I mean, I just, the blanket rule in the Fourth Amendment context.
You ought to be citing the drug cases on blanket rules.
That's right. I mean, and you can look at what happened in Richards, where I have a quote from here from Richards in the U.S. Supreme Court that says, the reasons for creating an exception in one category can relatively easily be applied to others. And that probably sums up the danger of blanket rules. We make a blanket rule for this little bitty situation, and it can get bigger and bigger on us, and then the Fourth Amendment.
Well, you don't. This is a rather specific situation. To ride in my car in the back seat, I'd like to, just for safety, for the officer's safety, and you say that we're going to, that can be expanded into something different.
If I were a much smarter person, I would probably be able to give you lots and lots of examples of how this would play out. But I think the danger in these Fourth Amendment cases of getting away from specific and articulable facts and all these reasonableness analysis is that we can't even foresee what areas this might go into. And the one thing I can think of is, so officers become trained, well, if someone goes in the squad car, it's okay to frisk them. And I'm not even necessarily talking about a bad faith, well, I'm going to come up with a way to put the person in the car, but suddenly an officer says, that's the law, that's what I can do. The potential for abuse is pretty ripe there, I think.
Well, Justice Prosser has a question.
The officers chase after Kelsey. They apprehend her. They ask her name. They call her mother. And as I understand it, they tell her that they're going to transport her in the squad car. And something like 20 minutes passes while another officer is summoned to pat her down. Did she know why she was being detained, that she was going to ride in the squad car, and that she was going to be pat it down?
My understanding, and I'm just going to have to go off of what I'm remembering now from the record, is that, yeah, that she did understand why she was waiting. But I can't get you silent.
Can silence ever mean consent?
Not in this case. Kelsey didn't consent to this search. Kelsey didn't consent to this search.
Is there such a thing as implied consent to a personal search?
Let me say this. Kelsey is in a situation where she's told this is what's going to happen. The officer specifically doesn't ask her for consent. Another officer comes and doesn't say anything to her and just starts. The idea that Kelsey would somehow be saying, well, go ahead, I'm fine with that, I don't think that record supports this. I mean, I think this case is just a clear no consent.
She says no, is it resisting an officer?
Pardon me?
She says no, is it resisting an officer?
No. Because the officer, in my opinion, has no basis to ask her for the search in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alicia. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Larson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. First place I would like to start is in going back to this bright line idea with putting whenever an officer intends to put someone into a squad car. Now, in the Fourth Amendment area, I believe there are certain bright line area, there are certain bright line rules that have been approved, but recently several cases also have expressed some caution about adopting bright line rules. They certainly provide clear guidance to police officers, but they can have drawbacks.
What are the bright line rules on a frisk?
Off the top of my head, I believe, for instance, that Justice Prosser's hypothetical with, for instance, when you enter an airport or a courthouse or something like that because of the special need to search people who are coming into to an area like that, is an area where I think there is such a rule.
Aren't those all consensual? I mean,
That is true.
They're broad things, like a blockade. It's not particularized to individuals.
That is,
that's
definitely, yes. Yeah. That clearly distinguishes
it. Those are the other bright line rules.
Right. However, what I would suggest...
Is there another bright line rule in the frisk case? Another bright line rule where you can frisk everybody or anybody who's in that particular circumstance.
Yeah. I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. I know that in certain types of cases involving violent crimes, I believe in drug cases, courts have said you still have to look at the circumstances.
Sure.
But those
now, if you know that person's been armed before, right?
Yes, that may become close to a bright line rule without calling.
What about everybody who's under arrest?
Yes. Yes. Well, exactly. That's a search incident to arrest, and that is a bright line rule.
I mean,
it's not a theory.
The arrest can be totally unrelated to anything with violence. So.
But there, you've got to have probable cause to believe committed a crime or is committing a crime. Then you have, once you get past that, you can search everything.
Right. Correct. And that can apply even if the search precedes the arrest, as long as there was an arrest in the case.
Right. Is there an arrest here?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that an argument could be made that there was, although the record is not entirely clear on that, on whether an arrest actually occurred. My best recollection of the record is that what happened when they found the gun... Actually, I think there's a question during the hearing by the prosecutor of the officer, what happened next after he found the gun? And the officer started to answer the question, and there was an objection, and I think the answer got cut off. So, but then, I believe it was a little bit later in the transcript, the officer basically said, well, first we intended to take her home, but then when we found the gun, she ended up going to the police station.
Yeah, but
now that's
the question that the chief poses, of course, was before they found the gun.
Right.
Yes.
Was there an arrest before they found the gun? That's
there,
not the theory of your case.
That is not the theory of
what
the
is
case.
The
there
theory
could
of your case? I mean, what is the state's position? Is the state's position any time the officer puts somebody in a squad car, including my gas situation or including this one, they can search a frisk for a weapon?
Yeah, we are not advocating for that bright line rule. However, no.
You'll take it, though.
However, well, we certainly would take it because we think it is a reasonable policy.
Yeah.
And
but you have a little trouble with that under the cases.
Exactly. The cases have been very hesitant to adopt that as an outright, in all circumstance, bright line rule.
And the reason for that is that in any encounter between a law enforcement officer and a citizen, there is potential danger. The officer is alert that the most innocent-looking person, as well as the most not innocent-looking person, can have a weapon and can hurt the officer. Therefore, on any encounter, the officer's is trained to be suspicious, right?
That's
so
true.
Once you have a bright line rule that if the officer is in danger, you can frisk, everything else is out the window.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that 100%, though. And here's why I say that. Because I think when you get in the area, as opposed to a face-to-face encounter, where the officer has a little more control over the situation, he has the person right in front of them, and he can see the person, see their movements. It's the danger of putting that person in the squad car, particularly when you're going to transport them and putting them behind you, where I guess the danger is probably more increased where it's only one officer transporting a single person. That's probably the most dangerous situation. But the reason, I go back maybe to the airport or courthouse-type situations is because it's almost akin to a special needs sort of situation. It's not a typical Terry case where the officer has an articulable basis to say that I think this person has a gun, but because of the situation that he's in, that creates an added degree of danger, which Terry doesn't ignore, we submit, and the Fourth Amendment doesn't ignore. So what I would one thing I can suggest is, as opposed to a bright line rule, is we look at what, and I think this is consistent with a lot of the cases that are cited in both parties' briefs, is that we could suggest something more along the line of a test, which would take into account the objective reasonableness of the search. And the test that one articulation of the test might be something like the following. You could say that a frisk of a person that needs to be put in a squad car for transportation purposes is reasonable where there's an objective legitimate need to transport the person, where there is an objective safety concern, and
safety concern for the officer?
For the officers or for others. And I think that Terry applies to, and that could be a safety concern for the suspect, for others in the area.
Is that code for suspicion that they might be armed?
In other words, the question is that Terry frisk?
Right.
Where are you different?
Well, I guess what we're saying is that this gives you a way to judge because there are so many different circumstances that can arise where an officer feels he or she has the need to transport
Let me tell you what the problem I have with your case and why I found the chief's theory fascinating about arrest. Assuming, and now I assume for the moment, that in order to frisk under most circumstances there has to be a suspicion, you know, that there aren't. And had the police officers frisked immediately upon apprehending her after the flight, I probably could say, okay, you know, she ran, she did this, she did that, maybe. But if their suspicion did not arise at that point, nothing happened after that to add a building block to the facts supporting a reasonable suspicion that she was armed. All that happened was that they decided to take her home, which is not in and of itself suspicious. So what you seem to be saying is that if you take suspicion, but there was none, but then you have to put her in the squad car, that creates the right to frisk. And when I delineate all of that, what you're saying is anytime you put in the squad car, you got a right to search. That seems to be the rule that you're advocating, because they obviously did not suspect her of harboring weapons when they stopped her, or they would have searched her then.
Well, I have a couple responses to that. Those are great questions. The first is, let's look at the flight, okay? And I think Illinois versus Wardlaw and Anderson say that flight is suspicious behavior that warrants a stop. I don't think either case answered the question of simply whether flight alone is enough to justify a frisk. However, look at this, and I understand your concern about the passage of time then. They immediately apprehend her, don't frisk her immediately. But you have to look at, in this record, why that occurred. And that is, first of all, because they wanted to get a female officer to do the frisk. Not that they didn't want to do the frisk. I think the officer testified that he intended to do that frisk as soon as he could get a female officer to do that. And he did that because it was a female suspect. The second thing I would say, and this is probably even more important, is that in the record, the officers, when they first made the stop, they still thought that she fled. Their subjective belief it was that she probably fled because she was a runaway. Well, they got the answer from Mom that she wasn't a runaway, and I think the officer testified that during that interim period then, they kept asking her, well, why is it that you fled? And they never got a satisfactory response. Now, I would suggest that if anything,
Didn't you say she was afraid?
She did admit, yes, I shouldn't say they got no response.
It wasn't satisfactory to them.
It wasn't satisfactory to them. There was a response, why are you bugging me, I think was one thing, you know, I was afraid. But the officer, and part of the testimony I recall is they kept getting back to why. They kept repeating the questioning and the why did she run? Because they knew she wasn't a runaway. And so then you get rid of that as a possibility, and what you're left with is the possibility, well, she ran because she had something to hide. She may still have something on her.
But in this case,
now,
counsel,
yes.
On the page 5 of your brief, Gonzalez, the officer, testified that this is standard procedure before conveying anybody, so it made no difference.
Well, and that's his subjective reasoning, and then that's where also I would say that's the officer's own subjective reason as to why he did the frisk, is because he intended to transport her.
Is it police policy?
My reading of the record is the way he articulated it, the officer, is that he was talking, he made it sound personal, like it was my policy. It may be Milwaukee Police Department policy, and I know...
Did you check the Milwaukee Police policy manuals?
I did not, Your Honor, no.
Well, it sounds like this isn't my policy, this is standard procedure.
Page 5 of the state's brief,
yes,
where we quote directly from the officer, thank you, he does talk, everyone who goes into the back of my squad car, I will conduct a search. He talks about what he will do. It may well have been a police...
The problem with that is it's not his squad car. I mean, he's using a personal pronoun.
And
it's the county's squad car.
Right.
So we don't know when he uses these pronouns, whether he means his personal or the county, because he has been confused.
That's a good point. I think it's unclear if he's talking about just a personal practice or policy or a Milwaukee Police Department policy, although I know that... Police departments do have that policy.
Counsel, to me, you were, in response to a question two or three questions ago, you were blending reasonable suspicion to stop with reasonable suspicion to frisk. You were suggesting to me that, okay, much like the fleeing case, the Wardlow case.
Right.
Flight can support reasonable suspicion that there's criminal activity.
Okay.
But that does not necessarily mean that reasonable suspicion to frisk has been established.
Yes.
But you're, and you agree with that, that they're two different concepts?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But your answer seemed to be, well, she was fleeing, so there must have been some criminal activity, and then therefore she might, then therefore they could frisk her.
Well, I wasn't quite saying that.
Oh, that's what I understood. And, you can't blur those two things.
Okay, and I think the problem is they are two distinct concepts, but you still can use the flight. You can use it to establish both the reasonable suspicion for a stop and the reasonable suspicion that the person might be armed and dangerous. You can use that flight factor for both. That's what essentially what the court did.
Do you need more? I mean, does flight not only, are you arguing that flight
not only supports, in and of itself, not only supports reasonable suspicion for criminal activity that allows you to stop, but flight, in and of itself, with nothing more, gives reasonable suspicion to frisk.
That they're armed.
Reasonable suspicion that they're armed, and ergo you can frisk.
Your Honor, it's a little hard to answer that question. I'll try. But I would say that...
Well, the next question is, what more do they have here?
Okay, yeah. And I would say, I'm trying to imagine a circumstance where a person might flee, and because of the circumstances, it may not be enough to justify a frisk. I would say that in most cases, yes, that's a that would support a frisk.
Well, do you think that would support a frisk when drug selling doesn't support a frisk?
Well, I think, again, you do. That's why I'm hesitant to say in every case, Your Honor.
Well, we're not talking about every case, but we're just saying you've got flight. Is that enough to support a frisk? You've got drug selling. The U.S. Supreme Court says no, it's not enough to support a frisk, even though people know that sellers have guns and lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
But that's not enough to support a frisk. So what Justice Bradley is saying is flight enough to support a frisk?
And
she's not saying it, I will. I think I said it.
I don't think the case law hasn't answered that question. I would say that in my opinion would be that yes, in many cases that would be enough. I think the part of the problem is you have to look at what caused the flight, the circumstances surrounding the flight, and here the fact that it's an unexplained flight, I think, is a critically important factor. The fact that the police thought she was a runaway, and that may have explained the flight, but when they confirmed that she wasn't a runaway, then they're left with no other.
The only thing you have here is flight, right? I mean,
we do have the fact that it is in a bad neighborhood. The police specifically talked about the area of 8th and Mitchell. It may not have been 2 in the morning, but it was after dark.
For reasonable. You're saying that her being at this. You're saying that her being in this area at 7:40 at night was reasonable suspicion to believe that she was armed? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, but that is one of the factors that can go into the, and it goes into the overall dangerousness of the situation, which I think is still part of the Terry analysis. Cases like Morgan and McGill, I think, make that clear that, yes,
that is. We haven't yet adopted the bright line rule that if you're in a bad neighborhood, you can be frisked.
And I'm not advocating that. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's another, but what the point is.
But you're saying if you have flight in and of itself, just flight, and if it's flight in a bad neighborhood, that combination of things allows someone that's a basis for reasonable suspicion that someone's armed. So any flight in a bad neighborhood.
Well, and again, we have also the nighttime factor here, too. It's a bad neighborhood at night, and it's unexplained flight. I would also point out that's almost a fourth factor here, that it's not only flight, just taking out...
So we're not going to be saying, I'm running because...
Well, I see what you're saying, but... the frisk occurred, and that answers the question of, the frisk occurred after... You know, this 20-minute delay, at which point they did have an opportunity to try to dispel any concerns that they might have, and that did not occur here. As a matter of fact, it may have heightened their suspicion, because now they have the reason that they thought she was fleeing is not the reason she fled, and so you're left with, well, maybe she did have something on.
Why was Kelsey sitting at the corner of 8th and Mitchell?
Actually, I don't think there was ever an explanation in the record as to actually why she was sitting there. She told the officer she was waiting for a friend when they first rolled up, opened the window, and talked to her.
Well, my question would be, did the friend ever show up?
It's a good question. Not in the record anywhere, Your Honor. I know when in the record when the police talked to the mother, She had indicated that she'd only been gone for about an hour, but beyond that, there was no other explanation as to why she was there, whether she was waiting for a friend.
Anything appear to be unlawful going on? They're there for a half hour. Anyone else sauntering up to sell drugs?
Nothing like that.
Anything in prostitution? Any indication of that?
Nothing in the record, just
on that. Just
the graffiti they talked about. But
and they thought that she was suspicious for waiting for a friend in the middle of the block because they think she should wait for a friend on the corner?
Yes, Your Honor, and there, too, you need to look at, I think the officer articulated her demeanor, the fact that she was sitting there with her head down, appeared to be withdrawn, arms around the knees, and at that time of night, he just found it unusual and was checking on her welfare.
Now, that's good police work. She may have been in trouble. She may have been ill. It's a caretaker function. There was nothing the matter with stopping and making sure she was okay. Right?
That's certainly our position, yes. And then they say stay put, and she takes off running, which of course heightened their suspicion, but then you have all these factors put together. Yes.
I want to know if you're prepared today to articulate what you think the rules should be when an officer is going to put somebody into the back of their squad car that they have not placed under arrest and do not have a reasonable, articulable suspicion that they have weapons. Should it be a blanket rule, say, anytime you're going to do that, in, or should it be, as other courts have suggested, that there should be essentially a consent given?
Your Honor, I don't think that it...
I'm going to write it, but you know what I mean by
yes,
consent.
Yes, definitely. Our position is that it, A, should not be an outright 100% blanket rule. It also should not be a consent issue necessarily. The problem there is because there are many circumstances that we can imagine that may not work, it may not be feasible. That's why what I would focus on is, if the court was inclined to do so, with developing a test, not a blanket rule, but a test which states, and this is consistent with really how a lot of courts have articulated it, wherever there's a objectively reasonable need to transport an individual, and I'm limiting it to a transport case here because I think there also is a difference between cases where there's an objectively legitimate need to transport someone and where, in some cases, courts have expressed concerns about routine traffic stops where they're just going to put a person in the back of a squad car to wait. The decision of the officers to do that by themselves could create the circumstance which would justify the frisk, and then you could frisk in every traffic stop.
So you don't want that.
So I'm not, and my test does, or at least my proposal does not address that for the time being, but because this is a transport case, and I think that adds added danger to the circumstances, because there the officer has less control of the situation. You're putting someone behind you. You've got all those concerns. And in that case, we would suggest that if there is that objectively legitimate basis and need to do it, and we would also suggest that perhaps as the court, as an added consideration, could say if the under the circumstances that they do it, if that's compatible with their police procedure and policy, then, yes, officers would be authorized in every case that meets that test to do
it. Has any state or federal court adopted that position?
Not exactly in that articulation, but in developing this, what I tried to do is draw from the cases from other jurisdictions. And in particular, we looked at cases such as Bernardo out of Minnesota, the Supreme Court case, which really tackled this issue a couple years ago. I think the dissenting opinion in the Scott case from California talks about kind of that same test. They talk about it in terms of either a duty. Some courts have talked about where there's actually a legal duty to transport, but other cases have talked about where there's a need, an objectively reasonable need, consistent with police duties and consistent with police procedures, that's a circumstance which justifies the police from doing a frisk in every one of those cases.
Okay, and can you please apply that your test to what you consider to be the relevant facts that meet that test?
In this case, Your Honor, it would meet that test because, A, you do have an objectively legitimate need to transport the person because she's a minor, because of the community caretaker function involved, and because the officers called the mother and spoke to the mother, and the mother made a request to have her brought home. Now, the counter-argument may be, well, there was other things that the officers could have done. They could have tried to convince the mother to come pick the child up, or they could have, I think one suggestion was that they could have asked her for consent.
Or they could have called a cab for her.
They could have called a cab for her. There are a lot of different options. But I would suggest, though,
well,
that...
Does your test take into account alternatives?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And I think that the test that I'm proposing would be meant to be an objective test that you could apply basically to every circumstance. Now, you're going to...
Do you start off your test by saying, even in the presence of other reasonable alternatives, so long as there are objectively reasonable, legitimate grounds to transport a person, the cops can search?
Yes.
So despite the existence of other reasonable alternatives,
exactly, and I think that's...
And the facts in this case, I'm sorry if I...
Yes, that's okay. No.
And the facts in this case are those that you've articulated, none other.
Sure, articulate them all.
She's a minor. Her mother asked her to ask the police to do this, and there was a third one, I think.
Yeah. I think you also have to look at the circumstances of the case here, where
kind of 9, 15 years old.
Yes, exactly. Under these circumstances,
the community caretaker,
exactly.
Counsel, let me ask. I think of this. My daughter Elizabeth. Let's say she's 15 years old. She's been involved in play practice at night, and it goes late. It's 11:15. There's no way in the world that she should be standing on mid block at 11:15 at night. Now, where's her mother, you ask? that she should be standing there 11:15 at night, not 7:40, 11:15 at night, waiting for a 16-year-old person who's going to come by and pick her up and happens to be quite late, okay?
Yes.
So the police come, and there's Elizabeth, and what are you doing here at 11:30 at night? Mm-hmm. Well, so they think, you know, something's up. Call home. No one's home. Mom's in Max.
Where's Dad?
Where's Dad? He's vacationing somewhere.
Scuba diving.
Yeah. Scuba diving.
So this is not related to true life.
No, okay. So can the police then, so I have your fact situation, except I've made it worse. I've made it in some ways at times later, you know, 11:30 at night, although mother comment isn't involved. Are the police justified then in frisking my daughter and putting her, even though she's waiting for a friend, she says, who knows, there's no friend around. Are the police justified in frisking her and putting her in, before they put her in the back of their police car?
Well, I think what you have to look at then, again, looking at all the circumstances, if the police, for instance, if she had told the police that her boyfriend was going to be here in a few minutes, no, I don't need a ride, something along that line, then that may be a case where it's objectively unreasonable for the police to say, well, I'm going to give you a ride anyway.
Well, what if this girl said, I'm waiting for a friend?
Right.
Is that what you said? But that's all Elizabeth said. I'm waiting for a friend.
Okay. But in my case, that's inconsistent with how she appears, her demeanor. But in your case, in your scenario, at least the way I look at it, she's standing there, she's up looking for a person like someone would normally looking for a
ride. So it would make a difference if Elizabeth instead was kind of tired and was sitting on the curb and hunched over.
I think it would. Because
then they just frisk her before they put her in.
Because again, it's a test that looks at the objective reasonableness of the officer's actions under all the circumstances. So, the fact that there are other reasonable alternatives, you have to look at, do those alternatives make sense objectively? And I think taking into account the fact that, you know, a frisk is an intrusion, and recognizing that, but you look at under those objective circumstances, is there a legitimate objective need for transportation under those circumstances? Not that it's the only thing, And in your case, where a person really is waiting for a ride and the ride's coming along quickly, the officer, of course, always has the option of saying, well, if you want a ride, I have to, and give her the option of consenting to a frisk. But putting that aside, that may be an objectively unreasonable thing if the officer seemed to ignore that reasonable request by her, no, I want to wait for my boyfriend. And then it starts to look like, well, maybe the officers are, you're protecting against that concern that the officers are just going around, you know, either offering people rides or picking out people to approach so that they can do a frisk. That's the concern that you want to prevent against. It's,
Mr. Larson, yes. You referred to the dissent in Minnesota.
Yeah. And in California.
Oh, sorry. Okay. That case involved a very different situation with one, a misdemeanor.
Yes, that was the man and his three-year-old son, I believe.
Now let's just go to the arrest argument that I proposed. One of the problems was the defense stated, and I want to check it with you, is in many of these cases, we have a detention of the person by the police officer for maybe 15, 20 minutes, a half hour of checking traffic records, car ownership records, etc., putting the guy in the back seat of the car, locking the car so it's not open from the inside. And in those cases, we've said that's not an arrest. The officer was just detaining. The officer didn't intend to make arrest. Maybe he thought he couldn't leave, but could, etc. So the danger in this case of saying it's an arrest is that then you may have a whole slew of cases where this detention becomes an arrest without probable cause.
Yeah,
isn't
yeah.
It? That's why you have to stay away from arrest.
Well, yeah, and I there may have been an argument that there was an arrest at a later point too.
Yeah. Here.
Yeah, but I have to concede that the record is a little unclear on that. There, and that argument was never pressed below.
But that's the problem for the state for saying this is an arrest, because then you will get into a situation where there's been arrest without probable cause to believe your time. You've got to give the state time for detention to call it something other short of an arrest.
Right. Now the only though I think there is a reasonable argument though that they may have had probable cause to arrest when she fled.
But that's not what the argument is.
Right. And then but then the question is, was there actually an arrest too? And I think it's a little unclear. But no more questions. I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask one more?
Absolutely.
The search incident to arrest. If the arrest is for something that is completely unrelated to violence, you can still conduct the search.
Yes, you can. Yes.
What is the rationale for that?
I believe the rationale is A, the reason that was developed, it was developed in part to create a bright line rule so it's easy to follow. But there are, I think, two rationales for search incident to arrest. It's in part because of the danger inherent in any arrest situation where a person knows he's going to be taken into custody and may have an incentive to flee or try to pull a gun or do something dangerous. There's that added incentive because you're heightening the situation. And I think the other justification is, in an arrest situation, it's clearly a crime investigation situation, and there may be a greater danger of destruction of evidence in that. So I think those are the justifications, which is a little different than the Terry situation, because that is primarily directed to officer safety as opposed to the evidence destruction.
But arrest is not always for a crime.
In the juvenile context, maybe, I don't know if this is where you're going.
Well, let's talk about drunk driving, first offense drunk driving.
Okay.
Or some traffic citation.
Right.
And that's the issue that's up before the U.S. Supreme Court, isn't it?
I don't know. I know there's a case, the Knowles case, I think, is an arrest on a municipal citation case, and they said that you can do a search incident to an arrest if an arrest actually occurs on just a municipal citation where I think it's just a fine. That's in my recollection of Knowles. I apologize, I'm not sure what exactly the issue is in the case in the U.S. Supreme Court, but that does bring up an interesting question in the juvenile context, because when the officers are looking into whether someone's a runaway, they're not investigating a crime, but yet the statutes allow the police to take them into custody to try to return them to their parents.
The statutes allow them, once they're detained, to be frisked?
The statutes do not address that, no, the frisk situation. However, there is an interesting provision in the Juvenile Justice Code that specifically says that a taking into custody under that section is not an arrest, except for the purpose of determining whether the taking into custody or obtaining any evidence there is lawful. So it's not an arrest, but they treat it as an arrest for, I assume, search incident to arrest purposes.
Because it subjects the officer to the same sort of danger of close physical contact with the suspect that a standard arrest of an adult would.
Yes, and I think the...
Just like giving somebody a ride does, right?
Yes.
Whether they're under arrest or not.
Or standing next to their car when you stop them for speeding.
Except your back to them. When you're driving the car.
but that brings up an interesting point, though. If there may have been a search incident to arrest argument, because even though it's not an arrest, if they're taking him into custody under this provision, once she's in custody, they may have had a search incident to taking into custody.
But we don't know if she's just under custody here. They're taking her home.
We don't know if it's temporary or, yeah.
Mr. Larson, thank you very much. Alicia?
I'd like to touch back on something that Justice Babbitt was getting at, which I think is very important, and that is, what is this test, and what does it mean? And I think what you were moving towards was, isn't this test a blanket rule? At least that's what I sat here thinking, because the way, and I tried to jot it down, but you have the need to transport, and if that need is there and reasonable, then it seems to me under the state's test you search. And it seems to me that that's a different way of saying the same blanket rule that we had in Morgan, except we've added this need element to it.
Well, I was looking at it a little bit differently. By the way, I think you're very smart.
I agree with Justice Babbitt. He has
birthday,
so it's okay.
I'm getting real old. An old person. As I understood the state's articulation of its proposed test, it was somewhat between what you proposed, i.e. consent, and a blanket rule. And you vehemently object to the blanket rule, and I can understand why, but this is not a blanket rule. The blanket rule, it seems to me, is any time they want to say to a citizen on the street, get in the car, they have a right to search. That's the blanket rule to me. Here, the state's test seems to be, and I was going to ask you, Grant, coming out of the blocks, what's wrong with this, that if there is an objectively reasonable need to transport someone. Here is evidence by mom saying, please take my daughter home. She's a young woman on the streets at night. And so an officer, even if there were 10 other reasonable means, call a cab, whatever, nevertheless, it was not I think it's a way of getting around what's the word I'm looking for?
Reasonable suspicion.
I'm having a senior moment.
Pretextual.
Yeah, pretextual, thank you. It's a way of getting around the pretextual problem that is inherent with a blanket search rule. So what's wrong with that if they can come up with an objectively reasonable need to transport?
Well, I think what's wrong with it is what Justice Abrahamson said, which was it's also a way to get around reasonable suspicion. I mean, that's how I see the test.
It does get around reasonable suspicion.
And that, to me, is a blanket rule, then, because what you have is, well, we can just look at the car. We can look at the squad car. We can look at the mode of transportation. And then we don't have to look at the search. Then we can just skip over Terry, and we don't have to worry about that Fourth Amendment stuff, because we're only looking at whether this person should be in the car or whether there's a reason for the person to be in the car. And then it becomes a blanket rule, eliminating the analysis of the search. And that's the danger here, because suddenly you don't have to look at the search anymore, because all you're looking at is why the person is being put in the car.
I think, to the contrary, you're just analyzing it for a different sort of reasonableness. You're not trying to wedge this into the consent exception, which has been found to be reasonable, or the Terry exception, or the search incident to arrest exception. It's a new independent basis for finding a certain sort of a search to be reasonable, right?
Well, it skips over any analysis of the search, I guess. Then we just skip looking at the search. We're only going to look at whether the person should be in the squad car or not, and apparently, according to the state, then not look at alternatives. So
it will be an exception to Terry.
It would be an exception to Terry. It carves out an exception. It carves out a Fourth Amendment exception. And as I started to say before in the blanket rule, I still think this is a blanket rule. I mean, however we phrase it and dress it up, that to me is a blanket rule. And if this court adopts that, then we've adopted a blanket rule that says if it's okay to go on the squad car, then it's okay.
And it's non-pretextual. This is we don't dispute that this was the pretext. This was not a pretext. Although cases will say pretext is okay.
And so I just can't emphasize.
How do you safeguard the police officer?
Well, I touched on it a little bit earlier. I think the police officers are safeguarded. I mean, you've got arrest, search incident to arrest. You have Terry. You have consent. These are big areas here, and again, when you look at the reasons that people are in squad cars, it seems to me that's going to cover most of them. And then the other thing is, if you don't fit under any of those, the officer doesn't have to put the person in the car. I mean, if the overriding concern is the officer's, I have this gut feeling, and I can't articulate it, but I've been an officer for a long time, and I don't feel right about it, I know it doesn't fit, well then don't put the person in the car. And that could have happened in this case, that wasn't at all the officer's feeling, but if it had been, then look for that alternative. And I suppose really backing it up, I mean, if there's not that, the officer frisks and the evidence is suppressed.
Your real position is it's a risky business, and yes, that's the risk, but the Constitution says it's a risk you've got to take.
I don't want to sound heartless, because I think everybody here wants officers to be safe, but I think we can achieve a very high level of safety and also have the Fourth Amendment. I think we can have both.
Justice Press.
You seem to have three options: under arrest, consent, reasonable suspicion. But I think it's possible to imagine situations where the police are transporting someone where they're not under arrest, where they don't have reasonable suspicion, but the person is not in a position to give consent. For example, if someone were ill, let's say someone is found on the street, not in an automobile, but on the street, but it is in an inebriated condition, some mental problem that they're taking to a hospital, what do you do then?
Well, if you have a situation where there's a mental issue or total lack of coherence, then you may look to Chapter 51, and I'm not well-versed enough in Chapter 51, but I believe there are rules in there in terms of taking the person into custody in that situation, and that may well cover that. And if you're talking about someone who's incapacitated, then I would say that the threat that they pose of danger to the officer, you know, if they're unconscious or just, you know, is obviously pretty low. So I still think that the officer is protected by what we have in place now to allow the officer to search if the officer needs to.
Chief Justice Bradley.
I asked a question earlier, and didn't
sometimes I know the answer, sometimes I don't. I don't know the answer to this, and let me ask you. Police can take kids in that are wandering at night. They can take them in custody under their caretaker function, a child in need of protection and services. You have an intake function, right? You can pick up someone who is inebriated, someone who's mentally ill, under Chapter 1, and take them into custody. I guess my question is, as I voiced it earlier, then after they're taken into custody, whether it's a 15-year-old who's put in the back car for purposes of intake, child in need of protection and services, or Chapter 51, someone who's just totally out of it, is there authority to frisk then? Do you know?
I don't know. I feel that there is under 51, and I'd just be sticking my neck out too far to say otherwise.
Thank you, both Ms. Alicia and Mr. Larson, for this argument. And if counsel would approach the bench, please. And then the court.